Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage,
how things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. We must look behind the surface of an object or the plot of a story to find the underlying meanings. And to do this, we must study and understand both our own and other cultures, says folklorist Barry Tolkien. He's the director of the Folklore and Ethnic Studies program at the University of Oregon. We sat in an office at the University of Alaska Museum in Fairbanks, looked out over the Alaska Range, and discussed some of his ideas on Native American material culture.
In the talk that you gave at the museum, you mentioned in a number of examples the value of an object to the person who made it as opposed to the person who's looking at it. You also talked about changes and the impact of changes. With those changes, wouldn't the value also change to the person who made it?
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. A lot depends on the reason it was made, of course. I think, for example, of a lot of the early Eskimo ivory work, which I was told by some old Eskimos, was often done just to be doing it. It's a form of respect for the bones of an animal. You're supposed to do everything you can with the animal itself, eat all the meat, dispose of it properly, and then with the bones you carve things. But then, apparently in the old days, they used to throw them away. And so the meaning was in the doing of the carving rather than in the keeping of it. Well, in modern times, people keep them and give them to their kids or maybe sell them to a museum, and the designs have changed. But I still bet that for a lot of Eskimo carvers, the real meaning is in the process of the carving. Those would be the attitudes that have been passed down. But I think that an item that was carved for one purpose but suddenly shows up in a museum, I think the carver would recognize that change in value as well, especially since some of them try to make their living that way. I don't think they're hesitant about those changes in meaning and value. I don't think they're as resistant to change as we think they ought to be. I've run into a lot of whites who think that if the carvers change their ideas or their methods or anything like that, that's sort of acculturation and, the old days are gone forever and so on. But I think artists recognize that change.
It seems like change is what prompts art to change, too.
Yeah, I would think so, yeah. The thing is that in what we have come to call fine art, the individual artist is sort of expected to change, expected to be unique, you know, an avant-garde. I mean, you hardly find a practicing artist today who just keeps doing the same stuff for years and years. I mean, they'll experiment with things, then move on to something else, and to something else, new media maybe, or a new kind of approach to the same medium. The thing in traditional arts is that one of the whole points is to see how well you can hang on to a tradition, and at the same time put some innovation on it. And so the cleverness is judged partly by how well you've met the expectations of people who already know what that stuff is supposed to look like. So it's another kind of task for the artist. So I think change tends to come a little more slowly in some ways. The thing about the traditional artists, like with the Eskimo carvers, as you can see from this ivory collection, is that they carved anything they saw. So if they saw a ship, they'd carve a ship. If they saw a seal, they'd carve a seal. I mean, I don't think they felt limited. But the whites think, apparently, that at least many have expressed this, that they should only carve the older things that they always have carved, and anything new is kind of getting away from things. But one of the things that's remarkable to me is that Dorothy Titus, who's out here now, I don't know if you noticed that big, she's making a baby swing out of birch bark. And she's working away on it, and she seems to know exactly what she's doing. She told me she's never made one before. But the thing about traditional art is that she didn't have to invent a baby swing. She's seen a lot of them. And in fact, they used the same thing for fish, she said, or they used to. In a canoe, you had something like that to hold your fish in. And so she's already got a sort of a community idea. She's seen a whole lot of them, but now she's building a particular performance, as I would call it, of that idea that's been there. And in that sense, it's not very avant-garde, but her own execution of that thing will be different from everybody else's and maybe even recognizable to other people.
Do you think that might be a change in attitude? That's a word you use a lot.
Yeah.
From almost saying that something is necessary, that you're expected to make something, mm-hmm. to that the freedom of being an artist as opposed to being a craftsperson.
Yeah, that's something that's hard for me to comment on with respect to the Athabascans here, because I don't know that much about them. I know that in some tribal peoples, if you do have a particular kind of talent at art, then you're sort of expected by the group to produce that sort of thing. A good pipe maker will make pipes for several people among the Sioux, and a good moccasin maker, like my friend Yellow Man among the Navajos, people come to him for moccasins. So not everybody makes moccasins, but he makes fine moccasins, and so they come to him. And so it's sort of like telling jokes in our culture. Everybody knows what jokes are, and we all know how to listen to them, but we recognize that some people tell them better than others, you know. And if I ask you to tell a joke, you might say, well, I'm not very good at it, but, you know, George here can really tell jokes. And it's the same thing with moccasins or with these baskets. I think the attitude is that the culture knows what they're supposed to be like, but there's a kind of a recognition that certain artists have really done it or articulated it so well that you sort of want her baskets, or you want him to tell his joke. You want this guy's moccasins because they're well known. And so there's that, see, they're both dimensions. There's that artistic value for the individual that the whole culture shares, but there's also that whole culturally shared notion about what the product ought to look like, too, that sort of gives the artist the boundaries of where he's working. Mm-hmm. Of course, some of these things are produced for practical purposes, too, and that produces some restrictions. I mean, at least a moccasin has to be made so that you can walk in it. And so that it can't just look any old way. It has to have a certain kind of a structure to it as well. So I'm not pretending that all of these are merely aesthetic principles, but I think that's the real issue when you're talking about traditional or arts or crafts. Anything that's supposed to be useful but is also beautiful or well done, there's a kind of a tension, or maybe it's more of a cooperation between form and function. I know that somebody has called quilts unnecessarily beautiful. And I think that's the good point, you know, that these people, you could do almost anything with birch bark. You could just roll it up and carry stuff in it. But the hours they spend in making it look beautiful as well, that's the artistic dimension of it as far as I'm concerned.
At what point, or is there a point, where something that is craft transcends that and becomes art?
Gee, I don't know. That, I suppose that's often in the eye of the beholder. I mean, you can see that a lot of these ivory pieces out here were made for very particular practical reasons. But you can also see that the decoration on them means that even the person who made them didn't limit the idea to a mere practical idea. But here they are enshrined in a museum where they're beautiful pieces of art, you know, and the guy who made the fire bow might say, you know, all I was trying to do is start fires. I think sometimes our perception of it helps us to see it as a work of art, even though the person who did it was just trying to be beautiful about a practical object. But I don't know where you draw the line. I think a lot of craftsmen are really artists who are applying their artistic ability at something that has to do with their everyday lives. And I think for them, although they don't have a kind of an elite vocabulary to talk about it, that's a form of expression that's very important, which I think makes it almost indistinguishable from art. The main difference, as I say, is that instead of being articulated for a buying public of connoisseurs, it's sort of an accepting public of people who already know what that stuff is supposed to look like. It's another sense of what's a connoisseur, I suppose. In one case, art in our culture has become almost for the elite, the people who can pay $10,000 for a painting or something like that. And in Eskimo culture and Athabascan culture, it's not so much the price as whether the thing satisfies the cultural demands.
In terms of that satisfying the cultural demands, is that then a limitation on the artist craftsperson to fulfill those expectations? Mm-hmm. And there's a danger in going in another direction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. In fact, I think I can give you a lot of examples from our own culture. Take somebody who lives in rural Vermont and wants to build a barn, or in the Amish country in Ohio and wants to build a barn. He'll build a barn like the barns around there are supposed to look, because no one wants to be so far out as to be laughed at by his own neighbors. And I think that goes for most folk arts. You can build a barn almost any way you want. Your terrain may be different from your neighbors, and you might want to paint yours yellow instead of red, but there's a very narrow range of colors that barns are allowed to be. You paint it purple with yellow stripes, and everybody's going to laugh at you. And no farmer wants to be laughed at. Not only that, his friends are going to come and help him build the barn. And what they're all going to do is exercise the knowledge they all have about what a barn ought to be like. And so it's a kind of a group knowledge. And sure, it impedes the extent to which the artist can get beyond the demands of the community. I think for a modern artist in our culture, that would be very restricting. You know, in other words, I think a modern artist would feel really held back by that. But I think the whole point of being a member of a folk community is that you're really trying to appeal to people who are very close at home. You're not trying to appeal to strangers with lots of money. In fact, you very often try not to appeal to them. But I think there are a lot of examples like that. I always think of telling jokes. I mean, you and I can tell jokes, but we know perfectly well there's a way to tell it. You don't tell a punchline first. We could do it as an artistic experiment, but I bet nobody would laugh at it. You know, in other words, we're just restricted, just as restricted when we tell a joke as, say, an Athabascan craftsman is when making a basket. But we still at the same time realize that somebody can take a joke that he's heard from somebody else and tell it better than the bunch of us put together. There's still an aesthetics or a feel that some people have, even though they're not doing something entirely new. They're just redoing something they heard from somebody else. I mean, the oral tradition is very much like that, and yet most of us who tell jokes don't think of ourselves as really restricted. We sort of think of, God, here's another one that you'd like to hear. It's a kind of an advantage. I mean, somebody has already polished this one for, who knows, 20 years, you know, and by the time I tell it to you, it can be a fantastically funny joke. In fact, I might even be able to make it funnier than the person who told it to me, or I might wreck it, but the joke is still being told by lots of other people.
Okay, I think in that sense we're buying into a form that we know is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
In that same light, then, is a Native American craftsperson limited by the expectations imposed upon them because of their ethnicity?
Yeah, I think so, sure. I don't know if they would see it as a limitation, because, as I say, there's something very warm about the acceptance in a community. If you're a member of a small Native American community, for example, or if you're an Eskimo living in an Eskimo village, I mean, those are high priorities, just to be in that group and to be received by them and to be pleasing to them in a number of ways, the way you talk and the way you act and whether you can hunt well and so on. I'm sure that in the early days it had a lot to do with survival. On the artistic level, I think there isn't any reason for a person in a tight community to want to do something screwball, I mean, because that's dangerous to the community. So this stuff tends to thrive best in very conservative communities anyway, where there's a high priority for that kind of harmony, you might say. I don't think it's a slavishness, though. That is, if people just start reproducing the same old thing time after time just because it's current in their society, you can see it looks tired right away, and everybody in the community knows it as well.
In your discussions about attitudes toward things, it reminded me of something that I learned about years and years ago via Kenneth Pike, linguist, and then Marvin Harris, the anthropologist, where they talk about emic and etic as ways of looking at things from within the culture and its distinctions and outside with your own definitions, and that seems like what you've been talking about.
Yeah, in effect, I think that's what, well, a lot of us have been talking about that in terms of cross-cultural education, or linguists are very much into it because we found that you can't just learn the words or the grammar of another language and really get very far into it. You have to know something about the worldview, what it is they do with the language. Like, for example, you could learn the verb system of Navajo, but what you really have to pick up is that for the Navajos, movement is what constitutes reality. So they have something like more than 356,000 conjugations for the verb to go, and we don't. Well, our language doesn't deal with that. Our language deals with things, and we're great on things, and we're not so precise on movements. And so it's in the quality of difference in languages that you start to pick up something about the cultures. And this notion of trying to see things from within the culture, it's a tough one because you can't always do it, but the attempt to do it is the way that you finally start to understand other cultures. And I think the real payoff for that, besides the fact it's interesting anyway, is that you start to see things about your own culture that you hadn't thought of before because you didn't have to think about them. I mean, there are certain things that just are automatic because they're traditional in your own culture. Gestures, proxemics, eye contact, that sort of thing. If we were both natives, we'd both be talking this way, looking off instead of eye contact. This would be really rude. It would mean that you don't trust what I'm saying, or that I don't trust how you're taking it. And yet for us, eye contact is an unspoken, it's not a necessity, but it's a normal thing to show sincerity and interest and that kind of thing. A lot of little cues like that are common in everyday interactions in all cultures, and it also extends to language and to custom and to meaning and attitude and all that kind of stuff, and therefore to aesthetics. Once you see it operating in another culture, you suddenly start to see how it operated in your own, and the more of that you get, and I think that's, well, let me finish the sentence. The more that you get, the more fully you can live in a multicultural society without being afraid of everybody around you and not being embarrassed about your own background either. It's something about the assertiveness and the stability that's involved in every culture that I try to get at in my folklore classes rather than something comparative. You know, we are the advanced nations, they are the underdeveloped nations, that sort of thing. Every culture has its own complexities, and when you get to know them, you get to know yourself a lot better as well.
Barry Tolkien, folklorist at the University of Oregon in Eugene. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome, delegates, guests, and friends, to the 16th Annual Convention of the Alaska Federation Natives being held here in the Howard Rock Ballroom of the Sheraton Hotel on Shalista Square. I would like to call upon Father Nicholas Komkoff, Sr., to give us the invocation.
Come on. We ask, dear Lord, that at this 16th annual convention, the theme of which is the people's land, Nunamsugi, that we, when we discuss issues of concern to all native peoples of Alaska, not only native, but also the people of Alaska, that you give us the grace to conduct ourselves in very, very good, and that we may think about the future of our native peoples and the future of Alaska. This year, the AFN is honoring the elderly. We should always remember also that the younger people, the children who will be taking over, should not be forgotten also. We pray to you, Lord, that you will help us to remember our heritage and also remember that we must do right for the future.
More than 2,000 delegates and observers assembled in Anchorage for the three-day meeting of the Alaska Federation of Natives. There were businessmen in three-piece suits, elderly men and women in parkas, young people in snug jeans. Many had buttons supporting political positions. For the meetings, held October 20th through 22nd, were close to voting day. Most prominent among those buttons were bright red ones, 2 inches in diameter, urging the reader to protect subsistence and vote against Proposition Number 7. The subsistence issue came up often during the convention panels and presentations and workshops. The theme of the convention, people of the land, and the emphasis on honoring the elders kept bringing the conversation back to a time when subsistence was not an option for people to vote on, but a way of life, and to the future, when regardless of the outcome on November 2nd, the subsistence issue would remain. Nelson Ongapuk of the Shalista Corporation, the chairman of the board of the Alaska Federation of Natives, welcomed the delegates and outlined some of the issues of the next few days and for the future.
It is with great pleasure and honor to have the privilege of calling this convention to order. First of all, on behalf of the Alaska Federation of Natives, its board of directors, and its president, I want to take this opportunity of welcoming each and every delegate from all of the member, profit, and nonprofit corporations, and all of the, and each and every attendee to this occasion. History has it that Columbus discovered America. History also has it that Vitus Bering discovered Alaska. For us, these so-called historical facts are not true. Who was it that greeted these first explorers when they first arrived? Who was it who gave them food because they were starving? And who was it who replenished their food supply prior to their departure? The answer to this question simply is the peoples of this land. This year's AFN convention theme is People of the Land. This is an appropriate theme because we as people, as natives, are being faced with many issues that unless we put a handle on them may have detrimental impact on our way of life. And those issues, and among those issues, is the question of the repealing of the present subsistence law of the state of Alaska. Let's stop here and pause for a moment to reflect on what AFN did in 1982. Among them, the 1985 study. For many of you attendees and delegates, this may be a new issue. However, Section 25 of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act requires that the Secretary of the Interior submit through the President a report to Congress in their first session of 1985, the status of the natives and native groups in Alaska and what impact the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act has had upon us. 1991 study. Subsection 7H3 of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act states that the shares of the natives in their corporations will become freely alienable to both natives and non-natives in 1991. In other words, in 1991, the present shares of the natives in their corporations will become saleable to others, and there's danger of takeover of these corporations by outside interests, unless the native corporations and the natives take necessary actions to prevent this happening. AFN has initiated a contract with the Alaska Native Foundation to study what can be done to prevent such takeovers and protect the interests of the natives and their corporations. Mount Edgecombe. We have continued to see what can be done to keep this very excellent high school open, but it seems that the federal government is bent on closing it. While there are some people amongst us that feel that this would be appropriate action by the federal government, some of us feel that until such time that the responsibilities of Mount Edgecombe can be transferred to the village high schools or regional high schools in a properly fashion, we feel that Mount Edgecombe should remain open. Advocacy role. AFN has advocated passage of bills or opposed the best passage of bills depending on what kind of impact they may have upon the native community. Some of the highlights of what we did in 1982. Yet, all that we've done in 1982 have been overshadowed by the subsistence issue. At the same time, the issue of subsistence is interwoven with these issues. I believe that one of the reasons for this is because many of the people who are not natives forget the fact that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was just that, the settlement of the claims of the Alaska Natives against the federal government with no bearing whatsoever on the rights and other privileges of the natives. I believe that this is an issue that we need to focus on at some point in the future. We as people of the land must not ever forget our forefathers and our elders. It is because of their perseverance, patience, and their wisdom that we are here today. If we had listened to even a very small portion of that, of their advice and their guidance, I believe that some of the issues and the problems we are faced with today would have been prevented. We, as people of the land, must not ever forget our youth. Together with the advice of our elders, we must provide guidance for them. We must see that the youth of today, as well as the youth of tomorrow, be given encouragement in their times of discouragement. We must provide them with praise and a pat on the back because of their accomplishments. Above all, we must do all that we can to see that they will continue to strive to better themselves through education, and that education should be both in our way of life as well as the Western way of life. Why have I taken so much time on these two issues? Simply put, the youth of today are our leaders of tomorrow. Our youths, ourselves, and our elders working together, I believe that if this happens, we can have a better today and better future. It is for these and other reasons we will be dedicating part of our 1982 convention to our forefathers, our elders, and our youth. We as people of the land must not ever forget the villages throughout the state of Alaska who have opted to become dry villages by taking advantage of the local option law banning alcohol. A law that was authorized by the 1981-1982 legislative session. This law authorized the village leaders in their villages to allow their citizens through local elections to determine by themselves whether or not to allow alcohol consumption in their villages. As a commemoration of this action by these villages, any and all activities of this year's convention that are sponsored by AFN, no alcoholic beverages will be consumed or allowed to be served. We, as people of the land, must not forget that we have our unique cultural values, that we are rich in our customs, and that we have survived despite many obstacles in our ways. We will continue to survive in our ways, and our way of life has taken us this far, and it will take us even further in the future. Because of this, we will have some cultural programs from time to time during the course of this convention. Lastly, I want to take this opportunity for bearing with me in my humble remarks. Thank you very much for being here.
Those remarks were among Nelson Ongapak's last as chairman, for by the close of the convention, a new chair was elected, Sam Keto, lobbyist and Doyon Limited board member. Also presiding at his last AFN convention was the organization's president, Senator Frank Ferguson of Kotzebue, who resigned as of mid-November after 2.5 years as president. We talked near the end of the 3 days of meetings.
I think the convention has gone real well with a lot of work accomplished, and there's a lot more participation by regions, by students, and I appreciate that. I think it's good to see a lot of the students coming in and participating.
What would you cite as the accomplishments of your administration?
Well, I think just trying to address all the different problem areas and making sure that everything was handled in a good manner.
Do you plan on still being affiliated in any way with AFN?
I'll be an individual citizen member of AFN, and I sit on the NANA board of directors, and we're involved through that.
Do you have any words of advice for whomever your successor may be?
I just hope that he's devoted to the villages and ensure that they're never forgotten.
Advice from outgoing AFN President Frank Ferguson of Kotzebue at the 16th Annual Convention of the Statewide Native Organization. More of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention next on Chinook as we focus on the honored guests in the audience, the elders. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
We as people of the land must not ever forget our forefathers and our elders. It is because of their perseverance, patience, and their wisdom that we are here today.
Nelson Angapuk of the Alaska Federation of Natives addressed delegates to the 16th Annual Convention of the Statewide Organization, an organization formed to coordinate the fight for a land claim settlement, and that now met to discuss other issues of common concern for the member village and regional Native corporations, subsistence, alcohol abuse, and respect for elders. Rachel Craig of the Northwest Arctic Native Association.
We took a look at ourselves, and we saw symptoms that we didn't have respect for elders anymore. These elders who were our traditional teachers in our society were replaced by certified teachers that we had to follow a law, you know, and we had to have certified teachers. All of a sudden, what were the elders for? I think part of it was we just didn't have foresight enough to continue using their wisdom. But because of that, we started losing our respect for the elders, and we saw that symptom was among us in our area.
Phil Tudiakoff.
In the Aleut society, all the adults look after the children, and everybody looks after the elders, besides learning from them as much as they can.
At the convention, there were ceremonies and panels to honor and recognize Native elders, people recognized by their own communities as knowledgeable in the life ways of their people. Oliver Levitt of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation chaired one of the panels.
Our next speaker, I don't think needs introduction. He's from Southeast. He'll speak to us on language, the importance of language, is Dr. Walter Soboloff.
I accept this responsibility and this honor in behalf of the other elders who are much older than I and who have so much more wisdom and understanding. There are so many way out in the state of Alaska who would have been glad to come here were it possible for them. They are sitting at home, they are enjoying life, and they have great knowledge of the culture of Alaska, and I certainly have great respect for them, and I'm glad that this convention is paying tribute to these kinds of people, and it's just my good fortune I could be here today to be with you. At the start, I'd like to say that when you become an elder of your own people, you are like a great book. You have so much that you know about the culture. And as we have these kind of people, we shouldn't look at them as putting them away or as putting them on the shelf, but keep them circulating. They want to be of service. They want to be useful. They want to be helpful to this generation, such as Andrew Isaac and the others who are here today. So use them as well as honoring them. They want to give of themselves, their time, their wisdom, their knowledge, to pass on to others who are here today and will be here in many tomorrows. My assignment is language, language. And we say in our Thlingit way, yuqatank, yuqatanga ya atxiti. Language is something. Language is valuable. Also, language is honor and respect. Shiawudane atutin yukatanik. Shiawudane. Kayaawune atutin. There's honor and respect. There's also pride in language. When did language start? We only know from what the Bible says. When God created the first man was asked to name all the animals, and he started to name all the animals. And so language started. It is said by some of the educated men and women of the world that what makes the difference between man and the common animal is that people know how to speak. But sometimes I wonder if people know how to speak. It is said that the whales talk, the killer whales talk, the birds talk, the bears talk. And so we are not the only ones who talk. It is only that we don't understand what the others are saying. And so we think we are educated. We think we know something. But way out there, there are many other types of life that are very good speakers too. It seems to me that our people, the native peoples of Alaska, never talked nonsense. They never talked foolish. They never talked ugly. They always talked with respect to each other. They talked with love. They talked with feeling. They talked with power. It is believed that we've been up here 10 to 20,000 years. A long time. We were up here before the Constitution of the United States. We were up here. We were talking. Our language kept us together. When the weather got cold, we talked. When the weather got warm, we talked. When we were hungry, we talked. When we had sorrow and our tears ran from our eyes, we talked. Our language is a very important part of us. Very important. Where did I learn to talk the Thlingit language? From books? No. I studied language when I went to school, German, Greek, Hebrew, American language. Where did I learn to talk Thlingit language? My own people. my grandmother, my grandfather, my mother, my cousins, my uncles, my playmates. But I couldn't talk. I heard them. My father was Russian-German, and he said, I want my children to be educated. Let them speak English. And so we started to speak English in my home. But I couldn't help but learn the Thlingit language. All of my playmates were talking, and I knew when they were talking behind me, but I couldn't talk, I understood. Grandmother would say, in our language, Chanik Hingana Guches, my grandson, go get water for me. I knew what she said, but I couldn't reply. I understood. Language, we didn't learn it from books. We learned it from our older people. They were the best teachers. They understood what they were saying. They didn't say, Chanik They never said, grandson, write what I'm going to say. They said, remember what I'm saying. So it was remembered in the mind, in the brain, in the heart. It was remembered. Today, we have educated people in colleges and universities who are saying to us, your language is going to be gone. It's going to be dead. It'll be no more. I beg to disagree. We have over 19 native languages in Alaska, plus English, plus Swedish, plus Danish, plus Russian, plus other languages in Alaska. But 19 native languages up here. How are we going to preserve this language? I'd like to offer a few suggestions. Number one, learn from those who speak the language. Young people, listen to the older people as they speak the language. That's the pure language. Listen to the older people as they speak. They are the best teachers. Number two, use cassette tapes. The older people would be glad to talk into a cassette tape. Tell the stories, tell the words, explain the words. Names of geographic areas in your native language, the mountains, the fish, the whale parts, all parts of the language onto the cassette tape. And so when the young person says, nope, I can't learn it from anybody, I don't hear them, that's all baloney. Buy a cassette tape, let them speak onto it, and young fellow, when you're shaving, turn it on and you'll hear them talking. Young wife, when you're cooking bacon and eggs or something in the morning, turn on the cassette tape and listen to your people's language. I have two grandsons. They're born into a Swedish-American family, and my son is half Thlingit. They don't speak language, that native language in their home, but every time I come to their home, I talk to these two little boys. They look like Taniks, Gusaks. They look like white children, but I talk to them in the native language, and I sing to them in the native language. One of these days, they might be able to start in speaking because they're hearing the language now, and one of these days, they will speak the Thlingit language. Another way to preserve the language, young people, get together with the old people and listen and ask questions. Get together in groups to save your language and start learning it. Another way is to live among your people. Live among your people. And another way to study your language is to try to appreciate it. if you're not able to speak it, at least when you try, you'll get the feeling of your people. Eat their food. Go out hunting with them. Don't be a stranger to your own people. Young people, mix in with them because they have wisdom, they have good spirit, they have love, they have everything that made life successful. If they weren't that good, we would not be here today. Save the language, use it as much as you can. Yewe Gunalchish, thank you very much.
Tlingit Elder Dr. Walter Soboloff, speaking before delegates to the 16th Annual Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.